This is Ben Hodges, recorded at his home in Sheffield on the 1st of August 2009 by Chris Eldon Lee. Ben Hodges, Part 2.
We were talking during the tea break about the relationship between men and dogs.
Yeah.
And you felt a very strong connection with your dog, didn't you?
I did indeed, yes.
Can you describe it? What does bind a dog and man together? A husky and man.
Well, for me, the welcome that the dogs give you when you go down to the spans is amazing. They just want to love you. They really do. Because they are chained up all the time. You can't let on base. You can't let them. They'll foul everywhere and they'll fight, and all this business. So they have to be chained on this span, and they can move in a diameter of about from here to that thing from a central picket. They run round and round, and they're fed, you know, by seal meat in there. But the welcome, the tail wagging, and you know the fuss that they make. It's for me, it was marvellous.
And you think that was for you, or for the, or were you
the fact that they're bringing meat?
Hmm.
No, you could do it and not bring anything.
So
you could go down. You'd get a welcome. Always get a welcome.
There was a meeting of personalities.
How does that define that?
There was a relationship between two personalities, you and the team.
I would say, yeah, having a welcome like that. They weren't cowed at all like that. They were marvellous. They were absolutely marvellous. Well, you know. Well, like I said, when I said goodbye to each one, you know, I left Dot till the last, and I sat and I hugged her. And...
Do you think she knew that you were leaving?
I don't know. I don't know that. I don't know. She gave me a welcome. She's very, very shy and sits very, very petite and, you know, wriggles a little bit. And that was always there. She took. And I was always welcome. I think every driver's welcome in that way.
Mm. When you went down the crevasse to rescue them.
Yeah.
Was it because they were a useful resource, or was it because they were your friends?
Oh, they had to be rescued. They had to be rescued, whether I have to carry them down the glacier one at a time.
Why did they have to be rescued?
Well, they are friends and they're companions. You don't desert. I think I would give. If there was a man in a crevasse, 10 feet away from the crevasse that the dogs were in, I would have to pay attention to the man. I would have to do that. But I'd be on tenterhooks about the dogs. We'd have to get the dogs back. You have to get your colleagues back, that's for sure. That's for sure. And the way my colleagues on that responded to what needs to be done was amazing.
The team working.
Yeah, what they put in, the effort I put in. I was definitely going to be the one that went down and sent them up one at a time. That had to be my role. And I wasn't frightened at all. I was just scared of losing them. Mm. I'm sorry.
It's all right, you did the right thing, didn't you?
Yeah.
Were you a bit puzzled about the Polar Medal for that?
I didn't know it was for that. No one. I found out about the Polar Medal quite a long time after leaving the survey to work on leaving Bass to work on the North Sea on the seismic boats. And you come ashore. We came ashore at Grimsby, and you have off an hour at Grimsby, just reloading with other victuals and stuff like that. And there was a letter for me. I think it was in a brown paper envelope, and I opened it, and it was from the Ministry of Defence, signed by somebody, and I've lost that, I've never seen that since, and there was this letter saying that I'd been awarded a Polar Medal, and that puzzled me, you know, I just didn't know. In fact, when I got back to Sheffield, I actually went into the reference library and said, look, I've been sent this, do you think I should accept. Can you believe that?
Well, How did they react to the reference?
Of course you must. Of course you must. And, you know.
Did you know them? Were they friends?
No. It was just I just wanted some backup. You know, am I doing the right thing? And it was in the November investitures, and there were a lot of people receiving awards, knighthoods and the lot. They were all, you all queue in an ante room, and it's in a room where there's a gallery and there's a band on the gallery.
At Buckingham Palace,
yeah. And you are just schooled when you're coming down. So when you get to the entrance, you just stand there and you wait to be called in. And everyone that goes in, the band strikes up a tune for them. And they tell us how many we've got. You've got to turn, you've got to bow. And you take steps forward and then you bow when you get to the Queen. She's on a dais. Yeah. Oh, it was Queen, yeah. She's a very small, tiny lady in green. I remember that. And she's on a platform about that high. And when you're coming down the antechamber before you go into the proper building, they've pinned a hook on there because obviously she can't be pinning medals on. And she has a beef eater comes up then with a cushion, and on it is your medal. She pins it on and she says, "And what are you doing now?" She probably has to say to everybody, "And what are you doing now, Mr. Hodges?" And I said, you just say what comes to your brain, I think. Yeah. Oh, I did say I was actually working on the North Sea with a seismic company. Oh, she said, that must be very interesting, you know. And you know you're dismissed then. And you're schooling, going back. You don't turn round, you don't turn your back on, you walk back. I think you step backwards and then you bow. Then you walk back three more steps, turn to the right, and away you go off. But there's a band strikes up a tune for everybody. And
what was your tune?
Oh, I can't remember.
Oh, right.
I can only take two guests. And I took Catherine, you know, it was me strong. I think we might have even talked about marriage, I think. After I bought that Triumph Spitfire straight from the showroom. And my mum.
Yeah. They were in the room at the time.
They were only three rows back from the front, and it's quite a big room. Mm. And I was still a bit to see them that close.
So where did you find out why you got the poem?
I've never found out why. I haven't a clue why. There's nothing mentioned.
So you were surprised to get it?
When I opened that letter, when we were sitting on the quayside and we'd been brought the mail, I opened this letter and I thought, well, what's this? You know, it just didn't kind of register, you know, the honour, if you like, or pleasure or whatever.
Mm. How do you feel about it?
Well, I'm quite proud, you know, I'm quite happy to talk about it. There are many, many more deserving people than me, but there's perhaps a bracket of people that do, you know, can receive the Paula Medal for what they might have done or might not have done.
So you think you're part of a quota, do you?
Well, I think so, yeah. But it's quite an honour, it really is. Yeah. And I got the Fuchs Medal as well.
Go on.
Yeah, did you know about the Fuchs Medal?
Tell me.
It was at a reunion in a club reunion up in the Lake District. And you all went up, you've got a few beers and there's lots of tucker, lots of grub on the go. And they announced that, we've got Ben Hodges in. I think that's how it works. We've got Ben Hodges who's going to deserve a medal, the Fuchs Medal. Oh, and I thought, blimey. I didn't know this was going to happen. And they clapped and out came, I forget who it was now. He's a bit poorly within the survey. It's a name game again, I forgot. It's on the tip of my tongue, it might not come. And he came up with this in his hand and they said, they would like to present you with the Fuchs Medal, but there's been a delay from the mint, not minted. So you've just got to have a substitute. It was a flat beer can or something like that on a string. It was hilarious. It was great.
But it was genuine.
It was genuine, yeah. But we won the Polar Medal. It was a squash beer can on a string. And so, they said, well, they've not minted it in time. And what happened then, I was called to Cambridge to receive the Folks Medal. And Sir Vivian was there, and the whole management were there. And I brought the other medal down with me as well. You know, the beer can lid. And Kathy was there. And when Sir Vivian used to present the medal, he used to finish it with by saying to the person that's in the group, he says, right, this is the medal, Fred Gibbs, come and get it. You know, and you walk out and they finish it on. And he said that to me, and I came out and he got the proper medal and he pinned that on. I said, well, Sir Vivian, I did receive another one. I was from the survey, and I've got it here. I said, you know, I'd like to present that to my wife. Would that be all right? So he says, yeah, of course it will. So I says, OK, Cathy, come and get it. Is that like... a lot must have known that it wasn't a Polar medal. They must have thought, two Polar medals? I bet they did. I didn't hear anything about that in the end. But so she came up and I put it on her neck. It was lovely. He was a lovely man. And we went back for dinner with him at home. He took us back home. To this house, yeah, with his wife. And with one of the staff, I forget the lady's name, staff. And it was a lovely interlude. You could see he was getting a bit tired. And
was in 96, wasn't it?
Was it? I don't know, was it? And we went from the dining room into the little sitting room, and he's pulling all medals and things that he's been awarded and showing them, you know. And it was lovely, a lovely interlude. Yeah, and it wasn't long after that when he died. I was the last recipient that received the medal from him. I'm pretty certain of that.
Is it the Fuchs medal that was his gift, was it? Or is it voted on?
It's voted on. That's by your peers.
Right.
You know, actually, I don't know where Al knows this. I did this for Al when we were sailing south. You know, you get a list of people and you say, what about this? And if you can show that that someone is worthy within the people that you mix with, that's what I was told, that's how it was. And... I don't know how I come about getting it. I think it must be the same way from someone.
Do you think it's partly due to the fact you spent so many years?
It could be. Your
service spans four decades.
Yeah, and perhaps it's time we got rid of him, you know, give him a medal.
So you have a Polar medal and a Fuchs medal?
Yes. If I knew where they were, I could show you.
Oh, well, but that's a little later on. Let's just flip back a bit, because there's two details I need to get from you.
All right, I'll do my best.
About the early days, back at Deception.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering, when you were building this hangar, erecting the steel, how do you know where to put everything? Where to put the posts? Was there any survey work?
Oh, yeah, there's some survey. There was a surveyor there when we put the foundation boxes in. They were about that square on plinths. Hmm. We dug the holes out. They were measured. They squared off and everything, and they were. I think we put a box in each one that we cast concrete on, because you want the level top, and that is what it is—a concrete cube in each column's base.
And you were doing that as well.
We were doing that as well, yeah. And they bolted down there as well. They bolted onto that,
yeah.
And we had a surveyor there with us. And Pete was very good. Pete Secker was very good. He'd been working on the Auckland Harbour Bridge when he saw the advert in this Construction News, which was this weekly newsletter for the building trades.
So he came from New Zealand?
He wasn't a New Zealander. But he'd been to New Zealand
and
he'd come back to the UK looking through the jobs in the construction news and some of that. But he definitely wanted to go home at the end of that summer season. He says, you know, this is not for me, it's been great. But because I said, can I stay? Even after the slip disc, I said, I can get better, I can ease up, and, you know, and it worked for me as well. But Pete went.
When you put the dog team together, some of the veterans and one or two new ones, you were working with a chap called John Killingbeck.
John Killingbeck, fine man, a bass leader.
At Deception. So tell me a bit more about him.
About John?
Yeah.
He's a lovely man, wonderful, well-educated, a gentleman, and he's a splendid man. He'll tackle anything. And we were good friends. We both liked to try and... They used to retire dogs, old beat-up dogs, which are not very good, back to Deception. So they had dogs on the Deception base. And we knocked together a little five-dog team. And we like I said, we went round the island best way we could. And that's, you know, John would love all that as well. I mean, we did it together.
Was he as mad about dogs as you?
Yes, I think he was, yeah.
And a natural leader?
Yes, he is, yes. I would follow John Killingbeck anywhere. Yeah, he could take me anywhere. Yeah, I'm his godson to one of his lads. Yeah, that surprised me. Well, I mean, we're good friends, I suppose. I don't know how it works.
There's an incident apparently where when you were going to the Argentine base with the dogs.
Yeah,
you hit this cliff.
That's right. Yeah, it was the cliff face. It was. We went round on as much snow as there. You know, we wanted to stay in the snow, and it was fairly high up, and we just contoured round. And then we got to the end, if I remember rightly, the end kind of finished. But when you looked over the edge, the Argentinian base was just down in the bottom. You know, it wasn't a 1,000-foot drop or anything like that. It might have been 150 feet. And we had to just lower the dogs one at a time, as I remember it. Just one of us would get down below, the other one would put a dog on, lead it down, and then you'd, you know, do it that way, one at a time.
And going back?
We dropped down into the Argentinian base. We had a lovely time with them. And then we sledged round best way you can. If you can find a bit of snow, you go round to the Chilean base, which is in Port Foster as well. It's the big caldera at the end. And we went round with the Chileans. I had stayed with them. Made a very big, good welcome. You always get the wine comes out, the meat comes out. I'm a veggie, but the meat comes out and everything. And... We traced it right back to Neptune's Bellows, you know, the best way we could in what snow we could find, because it's not like further south, there's not so much snow there. But we got down there to where there's a little lighthouse that flashes a light through Neptune's Bellows. And there was no sea ice then. Can't remember there being sea ice in Whalers Bay. And I think we were the fixtures with a dinghy. Now, I'm not, memories, 73-year-old memory doesn't kind of tell me that that's the real situation. But we had a lovely time.
How were communications with the Argentinians?
Very, very good. Very, very good. You could walk round on the beach when the tide was down a bit. You could walk round the beach and they'd give you a great welcome. The wine would come out, the beef would come out, and this, that, and you'd be
great. What but, language?
It wouldn't be Spanish because I neither of us spoke Spanish then. There was English amongst them, English language amongst them. But then, after you'd say goodbye, you had a good time, this, that, the other, you could expect them to come and visit you, and they do, and they enjoy it. They enjoy it with us. It's just the same, and it's the same with the Chileans. But they have got farther to go. You know, they've got much farther to go. They weren't nuisances or anything. They were always made welcome. They loved to come.
One or two people have suggested that the Argentinians didn't really like being there very much.
They're not polar heroes, if you like. Like the Brits might think we're polar heroes, the Brits. The attitude's not the same. They'll stay inside for as long as they can. You know, they'll certainly clothe very, very well if they're going to go out. And it's not really warranted, and certainly at Deception. You wouldn't see them in winter, you know.
A bit nesh,
really. Oh, aye, yeah, yeah.
Let's go forward then to the 1990s. And the decision to go back south again after 20 years
distance away. Yeah, big gap.
20 years gap. What happened to
Ben? We were at the Royal Geographical Society. I don't know what for. I think we'd gone for a talk. I think it was part of Ran Fine's efforts to go around, to cross Antarctica and all this business. I think it was for that. And I got talking to a chap called Al Smith. He was a big, fine figure in Bass. And Halley Bay, the project at Halley Bay was his responsibility. And he got talking, he said, oh, we're building a steel platform and stuff like that. We keep looking for steel. I says, I've been a steel erector. He says, I can do that kind of thing. So she says, well, do you fancy coming have a go? And Cathy was there with me. And she would have listened to what we said. And she knows that if I'm like to do something and she vets it, it's all right. She's going to be left on her own, as you know. And so he says, well, come down and see me at Bass and we'll talk it all over. But I said, he says, yeah, we've got a place for steel erectors. And that's how it happened.
Did you have to think twice?
I didn't, know. And once it was okayed, I saw Cathy, well, she it's the kind of thing she might expect me to do. I was allowed to go ahead. And he signed me on and down I came.
What differences did you spot after being away for 25 years?
Well, I'd never been to Halley Bay before.
Right.
I'd been on the peninsula mainland, whereas this right across the Weddell Sea, in that big ice shelf in the bottom corner, it was a new venture. It was an exciting venture. Because you have to find a ramp, then the ship gets in as close as it can, and this, that, and the other. And you're offloading stores, you've got to watch the ice shelf breaking away. If it does, you've got to watch out for things like that. And there's snow cats waiting to pick all the gear up, and there's activity. And I enjoyed it very much. Yeah, I enjoyed it very much.
But it was very different on the East Coast, isn't it, from the West Coast? Did it feel different?
Yes, it's very different in Halley Bay. You know, you've got to get onto the top of the ice shelf anyway there, and so they usually find a ramp, or they have to lower the cargo over the side of the ship when it's tied up against the ice edge, and everything's dropped onto sledges that are attached to snowcats. And I got a job driving the snowcats as well. You know, backwards and forwards. I loved it. It was great.
Were you reunited with dogs, or had that finished by then?
I don't think there were any dogs there then.
No.
Hang on a sec, they might have been. I should remember it. Because they used to keep them in tunnels at Halley when they had... They did have dog teams there, you know. I never went out with a dog team there. I can't remember that, to be quite honest. And I think they were below the ice. They used to hollow out the ice and they kept the dogs there, particularly through the winter. And I was only there for the summer.
Tell me a bit more about jacking up the base, because it sounds like...
Well, there are 20 legs, stanchion legs, down each side, 10 on each side, right? These are built up from channels with cross plates, so they're nice, sturdy legs. Channels back to back, and there's a jack with two handles on, right? And it's operating the screw that's going very, very slowly. And you've got to do them all in unison when you're jacking the platform up, or it'll twist and rock. You've all got to move it up at the same level. So that's two chaps on every stanchion, 10 at once, 10 pairs at one side, 10 pairs at the other.
Simultaneously.
Now, I don't know how it was monitored for going up without twisting it. I can't remember that, because that wasn't my scene. I was just there to do... to do the rough work, if you like, same as a lot of us.
So would require 40 men then, would it?
10 columns, 2 men per column, yeah, 40 men. And it is labour intensive. That's why they would never entertain another structure like that, because it's labour intensive. It's all right if you switch one on. If you switched it on and it jacked it up itself, you know, on everyone. It'd be all right if it could work like that, but it wasn't like that. It was a German design as well.
How often would they have to do it?
Well, they have to do it at the end of every winter, the beginning of every summer. What happens, it's the idea is that the wind scours underneath and it accelerates in a venturi, right? But what's happening, where it's going in, it forms a wind scoop like that, and the wind scoop is building up. And where it's flowing out, once it loses its speed, it's building a big dump at the other side. So in the end, although it's scouring the ice underneath, it's building up at both sides. But they've got bulldozers, tractors with big blades on, and they have to spread it out best they can. But it's hard packed snow, certainly on the side where it's blowing, where it hits the platform first, forms this big wind scoop. You've got the platforms there with all the legs, big wind scoop there, and polished ice under there as it's accelerated through. And then as it's gone through the building, through the structure, it's all, the pressure comes off and it's just dumped at the other side. So in the end, it's living in a hollow anyway. Mm-hmm. And if it's not groomed, then it could, in say a long bad blizzard, it could almost be buried, I suppose.
Mm. This is a very naive question. If I want to move a wardrobe, I'd empty it first. Did you have to empty the base to raise it up?
No.
But people wouldn't be working inside still, would they? Or would they?
I think they would. The cook would be cooking and this, that and the other. In fact, when you had to put extensions on the legs after so many seasons, because the snow build-up is that big, so you'd come down with extensions that you'd put on, and you jack through the extension onto the through the collar where the extension goes on, and you could raise it up that way. So it's on very, very long columns.
And what were the feet standing on?
They had a bed, and I think they put them on pallets. I didn't see that process because I didn't get down on the first lot of builders, if you like, because when I was talking to Al Smith about being a steel erector and going to see, and he says, well, we need steel erectors there. So obviously a lot of it was built. The structure on top wasn't built. It was in process of building. These were all panelled and double glazing and all this. But if it gets, what happens, you have to put an extension of your leg on each one. The snow's getting too high, so you drag through that onto that. So in the end, and also it's moving, you know, it's moving. So it can twist and distort and everything.
So you're correcting that every year as well?
Yes, well, you're right, you're doing that every year. Mm. Yeah, you're supposed to all take it up at the same speed. Because I was put in charge of one of the shifts, and they'd brought down with him, I think it was a dozen Royal Engineers squaddies. And I was given them on my shift, and they were buggers, they were. they'd either jack like mad and then stop. They wouldn't do it so that we kept the whole thing level. And they're really a bad bunch, really a bad bunch.
And this would take several days, would it?
Yes, it would. Yeah, so labour intensive. That was the ones they've got now. The new one, it's been built in South Africa. It's on telescopic legs, and it's on skids, and they can move it. They can groom it so it's level at the end of the winter season, and they can move it to a level area. So it can be sledged around. It's like it's a state-of-the-art structure it is.
There was when you were there, that 1991, it was a short season because you had to come away. Is that right?
1991.
Sorry, 91-92, I beg your pardon. 91-92.
Oh, we couldn't get in because of the fast ice 1 year. It might have been that year. So all we had was, I think, about 2 weeks. We've got to do everything in, say, 2 weeks, because the ship's got to leave at a certain date or you're going to get trapped in the Weddell Sea.
So you had to readjust the base in 2 weeks flat?
Yeah, I think it was 3 weeks from docking at the ice edge and sailing off. And we've probably all on four or five months' pay It was very, very generous, really, I thought. I thought, you know, just because it's been a bit...
So they shipped all these men south for a few weeks just to do this job?
I don't know why they put the squaddies on, I'm sure. But you have to have two men. You have to have 40 men on base. And the men on base are today, I don't know how many they might be. Everybody's got to chip in and do the bit.
You found yourself on board the James Clark Ross at some point.
Yeah, that's right. Well, me and a lot of the lads sailed down from, I think it was Grimsby, on the maiden voyage of the James Clark Ross.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. I've got a photograph somewhere, taken at Stanley, a black and white photograph. Somebody's taken a photograph. I was all stood in at the side of the hole there.
How was that?
Oh, it was excellent. Yeah, it has ballast tanks which stop it from rolling as well. So I don't know. It was explained to me how it worked, but it doesn't roll all over the place. It counteracts the roll. I think it's stuff that's pumped from one side to the other in the hull.
A brand new ship?
Yes, brand new ship, yeah.
All mod cons?
Yeah, all mod cons, yeah.
There's rumour about a sauna of some sort.
Yes, there's a sauna, and it's a little gym as well there, down in the sauna room. Is there bicycle.
Is there a sauna story?
Sauna story. I used to like the saunas. Yeah, I used to go down to the saunas when they went for the afternoon kip, just like everybody did. I'd go down to the sauna, have a big sauna, and then I'd get on there was just one bicycle. You know, and I'd get a real sweat up on the bicycle. I'd have a set of headphones with a tape that I liked, and pedalled away, got a big lather up, and straight into the sauna.
Right, there's a note here from Alan which suggests the sauna was good for chatting to ladies.
Yes, there was. Yeah, I was in there when there was a lady in there. Yes. So I mean, the female scientists, you know, the one of the boys, if you like. Mm. And it's not vulgar or anything like that. There's nothing kind of racy happens. Oh, well, there you go.
I've got to ask you about walking back from Stanley with the director. And
oh, yes.
What's all this about,
Ben? It's, there was all the hierarchy there. And we'd been having a few beers in the bars in Stanley. And I thought I'd met them at the bus stop to go round the road, and it was dark. And the bus never appeared. It was dark, it was night. So I says, well, look, I've walked along this beach and everything from, you know, rather than walk up to the road and all the way across and then all the way down, I've walked on this beach stacks of times. I said, I can get us back there. And it was pitch dark. I lost the track and we were stumbling through tussock and water and everything. Oh, dear. And it was very embarrassing for me, yes, because I thought, well, you know, this is great. I'm leading the hierarchy here. But I was in the wrong, not quite the right direction. Did get there.
Who were the people? Who was it?
The names. Al remembers the names.
Right. Don't worry about it.
Al remembers the names better. Alan wasn't there, but he was in the pub.
Let's talk about your time then at Rothera, if we may. Because
yeah.
In September 91,
yeah.
You then did the first of four...
Seasons.
Four seasons at Rotherham.
Yeah. I was a base GA,
so your
general assistant.
Steel erecting skills were not particularly required.
No, not at all. Oh, we did. We built a hooped structure for keeping the machines in,
keeping all the skidoos
and snowcats and stuff. That was a nice little. At least we put the found. I put help with the guys that were builders in the past. You know, but they were. Been with Bass for a long time, and we put the foundations in, which was fine. We had to mix a lot of concrete because I know we had. I remember me getting covered in cement dust because we have to take it in turns to load up the mixer. It's all manually done. You know, you're opening bags and you're throwing them in, and you're throwing water in to keep the dust down, and. But my eyes got very sore with all this cement dust, and I had to go and see the doc in the end, but he cleaned the eyes and everything, and the nostrils and all this. And we put the foundations in. They were done. One of the guys was fit with a theodolite and a dumpy level, made sure they were all level when we put the wooden frames in and everything. Cast all the concrete, let that set. with fixings that were going to take part. It was a structure like that with two flat ends.
Yeah, like a Nissen hut.
A Nissen hut, that's right. And we just used to. Why did we used to do this? We used to lay one. You used to have to build up the arch, and you'd lay it on the concrete back, and you could actually rear it up, right? And you'd bolt it down, and then you'd do the same with another one, same with another one, and then you box the blind end in, and you've got a building there, so you can get in and out with the machinery, not getting it all snowed in and everything like that.
So the old skills came in handy.
Yeah, they did. I was put on the cement mixer because it's a vigorous sort of a thing, and I quite enjoyed it. Keeping it going all the time, so they're not waiting for the next two or three barrel loads.
When you told Cathy you were going to go down again, you'd been to Halley, and you then said to Cathy, "Oh, guess where I'm going next? I'm going to Rotherham."
Well, I didn't say it like that. You know,
what did you do? Tell me.
Well, I can't. I just said, you know, I would be right for a shorter season. A much shorter season, and but she must have said yes. I'm sure she'd. There was no bad feelings because I think she's been used to that kind of thing. Me being away a lot. I mean, I've just got back from trying to walk the full length of the Pyrenees, from the Bay of Biscay to the Mediterranean. Now that would have taken. We're hoping it's going to take just between 40 and 50 days. Because there's massive ascent and massive descent. It's not just a path. And one of the guys dropped out already. And when we got halfway, we realised it's just going to take too long, you know. So I kicked myself for not going on alone. Because I was in pretty good shape at that time. We'd ascended a descent about 47,000 feet. From the Bay of Biscay to halfway across, roughly halfway. And the guy I was with, he says, "Well, I really got to go. I've got to get go here now." It was where there was a tunnel, or well, the Bielsa tunnel. It's roughly in the middle of the Pyrenees, and then at a little tiny village called Pazan. And I think he had a hidden agenda agenda, to tell you the truth. It kind of dawned on me that I know where he's going now, because he was in a walking group and they go walking, and they were walking into the Alps that year, Chamonix, and he wanted to get to Chamonix because he'd bought a ticket, plane ticket, to fly in with them, and he says, I can't hike it anymore. I could climb a lot better than him. I could get there a lot quicker. And he did struggle. We were carrying, we were both carrying the same weights, about 32 pounds, which is too much to do all that for that length of time. But from Pazan, Cathy said, "Well, you know, I don't want you doing things alone, because it is, there are dangerous sections on it."
This is quite recent, is it?
Last July.
All right.
Last July, yeah. And so I said, "Well, we'll both go back." And we did, and we had a nice trip back. But it dawned on me that I should have bitten the bullet and carried on my own. It would have been a real, well, I suppose, feather in my cap, really, as much as much as anything. I'd boast about it anyway. Let's put it that way.
Let me take you back to Rotherham then, because right. You did some steel erecting, but presumably you were doing other kinds of work as well.
It wasn't much steel erecting. It was all like very light stuff that. Yeah, it wasn't stanchions and stuff like that.
But you were a general assistant, so you were doing lots of other
things. Yeah, I used to handle the waste as well. I used to collect the waste. We had compactors there. That used to make bales of stuff. You could crush these and it would hold it. And then you crush it, till you've got a bale as big as that sideboard. And it's all bound up artificially. You get that out, you put it on one of the machines on the forks and take it down to the beach, ready to load onto the ships, because everything's got to come out. It's got to be cleaned out. And I like that idea. It was great. Yeah, it was good. I enjoyed that because there was, and I used to do a lot of, when I say co-piloting, that don't mean say I'm flying the other, well, I did have a hands-on, you know, with, you get to know the pilots and you know, he let you have a little go on the on the seat at the side of him.
So you're doing a lot of flying, were you?
Yeah, I was. I used to go whenever they wanted somebody to go with them to pick up geological specimens down the peninsula. I was always willing to go. Sometimes on your day off, Sunday, they couldn't get anybody, but I would go on a Sunday as well if they were flying to pick. I loved it. I think it was fantastic.
You were a Sunday cook one.
Oh, yeah.
Once or twice.
Yeah, that's. I'm not a cook at all. I'm not. I'm not. I know I've got to do a bit, and I was going to do it with a newcomer who was going to spend a couple of winters there. And I said, well, look, you need the experience. I said, what I'll do, I'll put a notice up on the board. I'll clear it with the base leader first, if it's all right. For a choosing of the charity of your own choice, if we can fast for 4 days, the one who can last 4 days gets, what was it, I don't know, so many pounds off everybody else. And he says it's going to quite add up to quite a bit of money. So that drew them in. You know, and in the end, I think there were four or five of us that stuck it till the end. And I said, but at the end of every day, we've got to do a couple of circuits of the runway, just to make it a little bit more difficult. And that worked as well. In fact, it was going to be a half marathon, but I think there were three of us that did the full marathon at the end of it all.
Gosh.
Yeah, slowly, but. Quite hard.
Was there any resistance to this plan?
No, not really. It was
okay.
And I did actually organise another nice little trip, which was how did I put a notice up? Drew a sketch and put a notice board off. How did I frame that? It was for guys that don't usually get off the base. You know, the GAs are always out in the field with the surveyors and geologists. And there's a lot that don't kind of... the cook doesn't get there. And, you know, they don't get out like the other ones do. And I said, there's a feature at Rother called Reptile Ridge. If you look out of the base hut, look across where the hangar's built at the end of the runway, and there is this, it's just like a reptile's back. And I've taken a snowcat up there in the past and gone to the top, and I've had a look, and I've walked it both ways. And I said, what we'll do, if I can get enough, I'll take the snowcat with the trail on the back, and I will take half the group, if I can get 20 going, because there's plenty of blokes on base, I'll take half to the top, we'll leave the snowcat there, right, and we'll walk down while the others are walking up from the bottom, you know, over this terrain. And it worked out well. You know, we passed each other kind of nearly halfway, and it worked out well. It was a walk on the wild side, that's what I said, yeah. And he pulled a lot in, the ones that never actually got off base. Yeah. It was slow, but I asked one of the GAs if he would, one of the climbing GAs who was actually on base at that time, I said, would you look after yours coming up? So he says, yeah, I will, yeah.
And this was your initiative, was it?
Yes, it was. I was quite proud about it, yeah. And, you know, a lot of them took it up.
You I think you were involved in cleaning up Stonington as well, weren't you, at some point?
Yeah, there was, I spent 3 winters at Stonington, and there's an American base there. Finn Ronnie's base was there. And we made a big boo about that because we put the seal carcasses in the American hut for the dogs. And I was at Rothera, and there was four Americans came in from National Science Foundation, and they asked me if I would go along, because I'd spent all that time at Rothera, at Stonington. So I said, yeah, I'd love to. So I got permission from the base leader. And I went down with them there'd been a good strong thaw, and you could see where we'd actually cut a hole in their roof, right? I dropped the seal carcass into the building, which had about a metre and a half of ice in anyway, but it didn't go down very well. You know, because I cut out the rafters, the tie beams at the top, and it was because it's held up with ice at the side. You know, it wasn't moving anywhere until there was a big melt, and it was starting to, the ice was starting to push it out. and they had to bring, had to have some timber sent down to put new bracings in and everything. And there's this hole, big hole cut in the roof.
This is the early 90s,
was it? Yeah, well, it's when all the dogs came down from Hope Bay, the last dogs came down. You know, because that finished as a sledging base, and the other dogs came down to Stonington.
So you needed more supply, more seal store.
Yeah, that's right. And what
was the benefit of putting it inside the American?
Because you'd always get to it. You know, if you have a blizzard, right, it's all covered up. But if it's in a building that's shedding all the deposit of snow, you can get to it. But we also had a seal pile outside on rocks.
And you hadn't sought any permission from the Americans to...
No, well, we thought it was a derelict. It was really a derelict place. But it was Finn Ronnie's historic hut.
Dear.
And I said, I don't know how that's happened. I don't know who's done that. And it was, you know, I fibbed a bit. I was a bit embarrassed.
Has it been fixed?
Yeah, it's fixed it, yeah. Yeah, they sent for some more timber and they braced the... Because the melt was quite bad, you know, it was... You know, it would have fallen down. And they had timber brought down, they reinforced it, and it's a bit of a museum now. They gathered together what they could, you know, all the bits and pieces, and hung them inside and something other. What happened was... when Finn Ronnie was there, or was it Richard B. Black? They had dogs, right? And was it the Second World War broke out? I think that was the thing that set things off. And they sent an American icebreaker in to bring the Americans out. And what they had to do, they had to get rid of the dogs, their dogs, because we had our hut there as well. They had to get rid of their dogs. And this was in 1928, I think it was. We weren't there then. This was the first, when the American hut was rebuilt by Richard B. Black. And they had their own dogs. And because of the war breaking out, they sent an icebreaker in to bring them out from the base. Now, the dogs, what they did with the dogs was, I've read this in their reports, they shot the poor dogs that were down on the spans near the hut. And because they had an aeroplane as well, they had an aeroplane to come in and take them, so many men out at a time. And because they thought, well, if it don't work out, we have to come back, then we're going to need the dogs. So they shot all the poor ones and they took all the other dogs up to up the northeast glacier to where they made the run down the glacier to take off. Same as our beavers did that when the Brits were down there. And they tethered the dogs around the start point of this runway down the hill to take off. Because they thought if they couldn't get off and they had to abort the run and there was no chance of getting the men away, they would need the dogs to get through the winter and all this business. But they put them in a ring with a charge. They were pegged down with a charge of explosives, right? And on the last run, they set this charge off, you know, a time charge, and the dogs were killed because they did get off. And when the snow melt came, when the Fids were down there as well and the Americans came down, we found one dog carcass which was lying in the ice at the side of the hut. So that was probably one that got away, that wandered back down. Perhaps his little explosive charge didn't. And he did say, the American basis, he says, you know, I just didn't know what to do, and he's not kind of proud of what they've done, and they realise that it's a matter of life and death, in fact. You know, we've got to hedge our bets whether we get out or not.
Well, what year would that be?
That would be...
Roughly...
When did we go down there to Stonington? Cracking memory just doesn't tell me. 1928 or something like that, 1930. I think that's about the date, because they were there first.
You were clearly aware of the meltdown, of global warming.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. It's an island now.
But even in the early 90s, it was evident, was it?
It was joined to the... Stonington Island was only a small pile of rocks, if you like, aground. You know, it's just a small island. But there was always one ramp from the pushing of the Northeast Glacier down. There was always a ramp that attached it to the glacier. That's how we used to get up onto the peninsula, up the ramp from the spans, up the ramp and up Northeast Glacier to, for the peninsula to cross over. When I went down with the Science Foundation, and it was a water. There was no ramp at all. It was just water all the way around. We sailed around it. I was, yeah. It was strange, you know. It was beautiful. The weather was good. There was, you know, it was an ice cliff. It wasn't a glacier snout anymore. It was an ice cliff, and it was calving every now and again. And global warming was the answer, really.
And you went to Fossil Bluff as well.
Yeah, I went to Fossil Bluff. Yeah, everybody gets to Fossil Bluff in the end, you know. A great flight down.
But you flew down.
Yeah, we used to fly down. Yeah.
But wasn't there a special job to be done there to help prevent the slipping?
Oh yeah, it was beginning to collapse at the front. So I set the task myself of supporting it with empty oil drums with the tops cut out and filled with gravel, because there was exposed gravel and everything, filled with gravel and bowlers and stuff like that. And I built these in tiers, so they were eventually resting underneath the front edge of the hut rather than it sliding away. I spent quite a few weeks at that. Not on my own. I recruited other guys as well to do it. And I think it probably worked. I think it needed doing. Because that enabled us to build a veranda around the front as well, on the side. Nice set of steps. Richard Casson came down, a good builder, built a nice set of steps with the handrail up to the balustrade. Or you could sit out there with the sun shining from across the sound. And look out, and it was good. Because it was falling away at the front.
Again, was that your own initiative?
Yes, I would say, without, not some sort of boast or anything, but I could see this is what I'd like to do.
Right.
Because I remember digging under the front to support it directly under the front at first. But then, because it was on a big slope, I thought I'd better build another ramp of these drums. And it was a lot of drums that were battered into the ground. Mm. I think it was a good structure.
Tell me about Port Lockroy, because that was your last job, really, was to...
That was a renovation, yeah, that was good. There was a team of five of us then. We went in, Dave Burkett, Dave was in charge, he's a good joiner, he's an ex-naval man, very good joiner, good builder, good worker. There was Rick Atkinson, who was a fine dog man. He's done the Iterod in Canada, mm-hmm. and the Yukon Quest. He's really fine. The dogs weren't in evidence then anyway, down there. And Lockroy, being the first base down there, was ready for restoring. And we smartened it all up, new felt on the roof, new battens, painted the battens, repaired the windows, cleared out what was a Nissen hut at the side where they kept all kinds of stuff, and that it's a real visitor centre now.
That was in the mid-90s, wasn't it?
Do you know, I can't remember.
Well, roughly, I think it was. But yeah, were they already having visitors then?
Oh, yes, yeah, yeah. They weren't supposed to in the first season. We were supposed to get so much done, and then if they came ashore, well, you know, it would be okay. The first one was an ornithological, birds? Ornithology.
Bird watching.
Bird watching. Ornithology. And everybody loved it to come ashore. The Japanese used to come as well. And a lot of people visited. It wasn't quite finished, but it was safe and it was looking good. It was painted, new panes put in where there were new glass to go. A nice walk up on wooden steps. Yeah, it was good.
And what were your feelings? You know, you'd worked in the Antarctic for 30 odd years.
Well, not 30 odd years, over a period of 30 years.
And now suddenly you were turning it into a theme park.
Not a theme park. We're turning it into how it was. That's how we saw it. That's
how we saw it. Original condition.
Yes, that's right.
But for tourists, all the same.
Yeah, they like to see the base. I mean, it's a post office now as well, and it makes a lot of money.
You weren't uncomfortable about.
No.
The Antarctic? No,
I don't think so. No, but they were coming anyway. Mm. They'd come ashore to. I can't see people stopping them. You know, they used to have supervisors that when they went to look at a rookery or anything, they kept them so far away from the penguins, you know, they didn't want to be disturbed. And they were doing that bit right. Yeah, I think, it was good. I was pleased to see Lockroy like that. I think we all were as a team. Yeah, I think we all were.
And then to South Georgia and the Whalers Church.
Oh, yeah, that was leaking. So three of us, but... cleaned it all up and refiltered it and everything. Yeah, we'd made a nice job of that. Yeah, it made it watertight. That's all we had to do with that, was make it watertight.
You must be a unique man.
Oh, no.
With so much work that you've done in the Antarctic.
I enjoy work. I'm a physical guy. That's, you know, I'm going to hospital for what I've done to my hand. For working too hard. Yeah, it's been operated on twice already. And I've just got to go again.
I can't think of anybody else who's been connected with the Antarctic and been working down there. I know there was a gap in the middle, but over four decades.
A lot of good workers get there. But
not for quite such a length of span. I mean, you must have...
I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the company.
You must have been the oldest fit in the business.
Oh, I probably was, yeah. I probably was. I had a big beard then as well, big set of whiskers, long hair and whiskers.
How did the others regard you with your vast experience? Were you a kind of a grandfather of the outfit, do you think? Because you were still down there in your 60s, weren't you?
I didn't pretend to be important to them. You know, I didn't think I was anything special. I mean, they did say that, and I did actually, in Fossil Bluff, in the little bunk where I was sleeping, I put all the dates down where I was, on the pencil, on the wall inside. And I wrote at the side, never ever, say never, never again. Yeah, I put a list of, you know, I've been to just about most of the bases, I suppose.
Do you sense a special position? Or a special relationship with the Antarctic because of the length of your connection?
Yeah, I've seen it at its best and I've seen it at its worst, I suppose. And I would go in a working capacity. I wouldn't want to go as a tourist, I think. I think I'd like physical input on it. But the memories are very good. I mean, you don't go that many times with free will, do you, if you don't like it. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed meeting some very, very nice people. You know, lots of ladies were starting to get down. That was, I saw my first female down at Sydney Island, walked into this corridor, and there she was looking at a notice board, and it really rocked me back on my heels. She was a young lady, and it was the first one I'd seen in Antarctica. That was at Sydney. And, the ladies are very welcome there. There's some of them are tougher than to the guys. I think, yeah. I had one or two at Rother as well. In fact, I don't really know, a leopard seal actually killed one of the young ladies. Didn't eat her, I don't think. I think it just dragged her on and drowned her. I wasn't there then.
I'm just trying to put my finger on it, on the special relationship between Ben Hodges and the Antarctic. I wonder whether you could help me with it. You had to keep going back, and I just wonder why.
Well, I don't like packing, ready to go away. Cathy will tell you that. I hate that. Once my rucksack's packed, and I think I've got everything, I'm quite happy to, you know, when we go to the airport and get flown. We get flown down there now, and Mount Pleasant, and pick up the boat down there. Or pick up a plane down there which flies backwards and forwards to the bases. It's just a nice place to be. I mean, I've always had friends down there. There's always been somebody. I've never been down there and I've not known anyone.
Would you say it was your spiritual home?
Well, a strange thing, when we did a telerometer survey at Fossil Bluff, yeah, it's years ago, and it's quite hilly round the thing, but you can walk around safely in summer when the snow hits when the sun hits the rocks beneath the snow and it melts very quickly. And I used to climb to one or two of the small peaks on, just drag myself up there and not rock climbing or anything. And I remember looking over into this valley at the other side. I was on my own. And I strongly felt, if there was a God, I'm sure this is where he would be. I felt that very strongly. Yeah, I really did. It was a strong feeling. And I'm agnostic, I suppose, and I'm not a believer now. I don't think it does work like that. But I had a strong sense of that's where he would be. I don't think I've said that to many people either.
So of all God's creations, that would be his favourite place?
Yes, this is where he would do it all from, if you like.
No, is it HQ, you mean?
I didn't think of it as headquarters, but I imagined him being there, you know, the spirit of God or whatever. I didn't burst into tears or anything like that, but I thought, you know, I think it's so silent and so empty.
So you felt nearer, closer to whatever it is there?
I did, yeah, it was a strong feeling, yeah, and I suppose God just entered into the equation, I suppose. Into
is
the
that
scene.
Why you were happy to go back so many times?
I was always happy there anyway. It's just on that one occasion where I was perhaps even a bit happier, you know, but quietly happier. Wasn't that that drew me back?
But it was a special moment.
Oh, yeah, that was a special moment because I was actually on my own there as well, just there in that particular time. Yeah, I'm not ashamed to say that... That's how I felt. It was a real feeling, a very real feeling. It didn't come again. It didn't come again.
Was
but
was it a physical feeling, like a shiver, or?
I think it probably was. Yeah, I think it probably was. You know, it was a sudden opinion, inward opinion that this is where it would all happen. You know, if he was a figure, he'd be here.
Ben, thank you very much indeed.